Guys, my fucking dog.
Is it in jail? Joker's in jail?
Joker got in jail again. Okay, so he's been jailed in Italy. He was jailed in Palo Alto.
When will that dog learn? I've spent quality time with that dog. He's out of control.
Why did he get jailed?
He got jailed because
he's a runner.
He's a runner. He's a track star. We sent him to like a, you know, like the dog walker where he goes and runs around and they come pick him up. But then the guy opened the van door.
He took off.
Anyways, he gets found. They're trying to call me because I guess my number is on the thing, which I hadn't realized.
You don't pick up?
Can't reach me. Well, I'm in DC in New York. And they put them in the kennel and we get this picture. And Nick, you can post the picture, but you know, because I sent it to you. Poor Joker in dog jail.
He's a great dog.
Is he back? Did you get him back?
We got him back, but he's back. He's out of jail again.
Honestly, he's only going to learn if he goes to jail.
You should get a little tag for him, those little remote tracking
bro
tags.
That's not, I mean, it's great, but it doesn't stop him from escaping.
That dog, there's something wrong with that dog.
Remember when Zach came over?
Yeah,
and the dog was like growling at him. Zach was like hunched in the corner like
it's the only dog that doesn't like me. I mean, every other dog trained in?
No, he's not been trained. We have to train him. I mean, I get it, he hasn't been trained, but he's so cute.
Did you train that dog to hate white people?
No.
That dog is a little racist, I'll say it.
We'll let your winners ride.
Rain Man David Sachs.
And I said, we open source it to the fans, and they've just gone crazy with it.
Love you, Wes. Queen of Kinwa.
All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of All In, the podcast that you've been listening to for 48 episodes. Here we are. On the precipice of greatness, 49 episodes in, with us again today, the Queen of Quinoa, your science ambassador, David Friedberg, also on the pod, the Rain Man himself, definitely his dad lets him drive in the driveway, David Sachs, and batting cleanup, the dictator himself, Chamath Palihapitiya. What did we all think of last week's pod with Balaji?
I felt it got cut off too soon. I was getting into a groove with Balaji, and I'm trying to figure out how to pick that up with him because I thought that we were getting into some pretty interesting discussion towards the end, and we obviously ran out of time. Chamath had to hop off. So it would have been great to keep that conversation going with Balaji. I really do think there's a big question mark on like how does the decentralized web or decentralized social networks in particular work with respect to kind of that, you know, recommendation application layer, which is effectively what search solved on the internet. And so I'm curious to keep the conversation going and seeing, you know, what this means.
I made the decision to end the pod because Chamath had to go, Sachs had to go. There was a hard stop. And I was like, I don't want to keep this going without the other besties. And people were very upset. They thought I shut it down abruptly, but we had a certain amount of time and we can always have them back. So everybody relax. But I did look at the stats. We each came in with our, you know, whatever percent pro rata, and he had double. So he had 40% and we all had basically.
Which is
equal.
Right for a guest, I think.
I felt right. Didn't it feel right?
I think it's important to hear when folks come on, what they have to say. He's a really smart guy and, you know, you can kind of just let him go and riff for a while. And then just react to him. So I think it's lovely to hear such a deep thinker think out loud, quite honestly.
Yeah. And even if you don't agree with him, I don't agree with him on a lot of his points about, you know, decentralized everything. I think centralized works for, you know, many things better. I'm curious, Sachs, you know, looking back on it, were there moments that you felt maybe you disagreed with him more or agreed with him more and wanted to lean into a conversation? Obviously, it's very hard to have five people on a pod and only get a certain amount of airtime, et cetera.
Well, look, I think Balaji is a great guest to have on once in a while. I mean, it does kind of turn the pod a little bit more into a TED Talk. Definitely have that vibe, but the fans liked it. And I mean, Balaji should have his own show. I mean, he can go for a while. I mean, he's got
for
a lot
hours.
To say for hours.
Yes, and he has.
He has, and I think he should do his own show because there's definitely a huge fan base for it. And if people want more Balaji, I interviewed him for about an hour on Purple Pills, which is kind of the I don't know if you want to call it solo pod, solo show that I do where I occasionally interview people on call.
Yeah, download, call in, and go check out Purple Pills. So, yeah, you know, I gave Balaji a little pep talk coming in saying, hey, listen, it's a roundtable discussion and I've interviewed you before and you can kind of tip into the monologuing and explaining very big picture things. So just try to pass the ball a little bit here. And I think he did adjust his game a little bit, but it's, you know, it's hard to have somebody like that on. I think you pointed it out, Sax, that it's more like a TED talk for him.
We're having a conversation and he's yes. used to being interviewed. And I Correct. Think that is that's a transition, but you know, it was fine. Let's move on.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we'll start off with something we talked about on episode 9, which was Coinbase's CEO, Brian Armstrong, wrote a very controversial blog, very controversial blog post exactly a year ago. Coinbase is a mission-focused company. At the time, he was dealing with a never-ending debate inside his own company about Black Lives Matter, about social justice, and any number of issues. And he said, listen, the company is mission focused. Our mission is to, you know, make people more financially independent, literate, et cetera. And we're going to ban any discussions on our electronic communications. You can do things on your own time. And it was quite controversial at the time. We had a good discussion. I re-listened to our discussion on that pod. And we all universally felt like it was the right move. Well, he went ahead and picked up the hornet's nest. He did not have to talk about this ever again. Everybody had forgotten about it, and he grabbed the hornet's nest, ran into the end zone, and spiked it.
Jason, can you, well, before you do that, can you say how many people left as a result of his blog post and all? Do you know those stats? Because I think those
I don't have those stats handy, but it was a dozen or two.
It was 5% ended up leaving. There was a big article about it.
Couple you got of dozen.
This was, I think it was worth him doing a follow up post. This was the 1 year anniversary of his blog post, and he was kind of giving us a status update. And what he basically said is that the policy had worked. So first of all, should we just review what the policy was? The policy was that they were going to declare the workplace to be politically neutral, that people would leave their politics at the door. They would not have sort of extraneous political conversations at work. That doesn't mean you couldn't support whatever causes you wanted on your own time or tweet whatever you want on your own time. But while you're at work, they would declare it to be sort of a political DMZ, like a demilitarized zone. Basically, all he was doing was reasserting the old center, the old etiquette of, hey, when you go to work, you're not engaged in
you're politically paid to work.
Heated. Yeah, you're paid to work. You're not there to engage in political activism. So that was the policy. And of course, the woke mob became completely hysterical about it. And so then what happened is that Brian offered everyone a very generous severance policy if they didn't want to stick
around
for the policy. Yes, extremely generous. So they made it really
absurdly generous.
Right. They made it really easy for people to check out if they want to check out. Well, only 5% took the policy.
60 people.
Yes. And then on the heels of that, there was a gigantic New York Times hit piece against the company, the usual disinformation and slanders against the company. And then now we have this follow-up piece. And I think what Brian basically reported is that today Coinbase is a more aligned company, because everyone who's there wants to be there for the mission. That's what they focus on when they go to work. He talked about how they had hired top talent away from other companies. I mean, basically, he put out the bat signal and people came running because, you know, we have...
They wanted neutrality. They did not want it.
People are voting with their feet to come work
there.
Yeah,
they're fed up with the politics and distraction. And I think the employees were secretly relieved that he declared this policy. Basically, he took the heat on himself for the larger benefit of all the employees who just wanted to be there and work and not have to wonder whether they're doing something right or wrong because they're on the wrong side of a political issue.
Freeberg nailed it when he said in our episode 9, which you can go back to, Freeberg, you may not remember your comments, but you said, what about the employees who just want to come to work and don't want to engage in political speech? Now you're infringing on them to force them to participate in these discussions and they don't have a choice because they need to feed their families, they need to go to work. And so Freeberg, I think you take a little victory lap there. He says in this tweet storm, I'll just read the third part of it. One of the biggest concerns around our stance was that it would impact our diversity numbers. Since my post, we've grown our headcount about 110%, doubled it, while our diversity numbers have remained the same or even improved in some metrics. So all of the hand wringing and pearl clutching that this would have a negative effect on the company has turned out to be wrong. Go ahead, Chamath, and then Freeberg.
I mean, if you want, I think it's important to set the context for what this is. There is a productivity war going on inside of institutions around the world. And what's happening is that people's personal beliefs are bumping up against what the mission and goals, operational goals of a company are, or a university, or all these other places. And so this is probably the first big example. This is a, what is a $50, $60 billion public company?
$49 billion.
$50 billion public company that basically said, enough's enough. This is our mission. Everybody else basically just needs to shut the fuck up. And I think that that's very important. Now, if they then go off and actually crush their goals, that's the one missing piece in all of this, because when that happens, then you can write a through line through all of this and say, okay, this is in part what allowed them to do it. So I think that the folks that, you know, were really up in arms still have one small straw in the fight, which is that if these guys don't achieve their goals, they'll point to this as one of the reasons why.
But the whole Brian, diversity is strength.
Or, you know, like, yeah, you're suppressing free speech, you know, that argument. But I think if Brian then goes and delivers a couple of knockout quarters and a couple of knockout years, then, you know, what he will be able to say definitively, which no one can refute, is we leave our politics at the door, we define our OKRs, and then we go and we build things that people need as a company. And then you go off and you can do whatever you want. And I think that that's very powerful for many companies and institutions.
Friedberg, you heard my recap of what you said last time. I'm not sure if you remembered it or you re-listened. What are your thoughts today?
I think it's worth just noting less about the particularities of what was said and the particular issue at hand here. And I would look more to kind of Brian's leadership style as an excellent example of defining and creating strong culture. Culture in an organization can give that organization what it needs to succeed. It puts everyone aligned in a specific way on how we make decisions, how we operate. It doesn't matter what his particular beliefs and opinions were, what to exclude, what to include in the dialogue and the discourse and the model for discourse within the organization. I think what matters is that he put a line in the sand and he said, this is what we're going to do. This is what's in and this is what's out. And organizations that do that and do that effectively generally win. They win more. They do better. The teams are aligned. The teams are more unified. And I think that definition may sometimes be controversial. And you'll notice that as companies get bigger, go public, they're larger, they bring in professional managers and the founder or CEO steps out, they generally don't do that, right? They generally try to not do that definitional work because they're trying to minimize loss and not kind of take the bet on maximizing long-term gain and doing the things that they think culturally define or will enable success long-term. So I think it's a great example of leadership generally on how you kind of can be very vocal about defining a strong culture.
I think Elon calls it corpo speak.
Meaning
most companies, when they get bigger, they gravitate towards corpo speak. And then what happens is some cohort of employees who are really good just feel trapped in this kind of morass of mediocrity.
And by the way, look at Elon's, call it attrition rate, right? By the typical large-scale public company corporate metric of like how many people are leaving per year, you'd say, oh my gosh, something's up with that organization. But it really speaks to a strong culture. There's a company that's famous for this called Bridgewater Associates, you know, run by Ray Dalio, $100 billion hedge fund, one of the best performing investment vehicles of all time. And they have incredible culture. I've talked about Ray Dalio's book, Principles, before and some of the work he's done on this, where he is so adamant about getting culture right within the organization, how you operate, that they almost have, I think, a 30% attrition rate after the first year of people that come in. Because they not only try and screen for these elements of what they consider to be the right cultural fit for their organization up front, but then they also screen people the heck out of the door if they're not a good fit. And I think Elon has a similar sort of model. And, you know, I think Brian, the way he speaks about the organization is a similar model. And it's about defining the lines. It's about being very crystal clear about what's in and what's not.
Whatever, if you, as a CEO and a founder, whatever you believe, you need to believe in it strongly.
And you need to communicate it clearly.
And then communicate it and then let people vote. They vote with their feet. They don't get to vote whether to change it. They just get to vote whether they get to stay or whether they go. And I think that that's a really smart
thing. I think that's well said,
I think there's one other issue here, Jay Callen. This goes back to your point about why did Brian have to bring this back up? Was it unnecessary? Did he spike the hornet's nest in the end zone? Here's why I think it was necessary. If you go to point 7 and 8 of his tweet storm, he says, it was the most positive reaction I've gotten from any change I've made in the history of the company, which is saying something. How could something be so negative in the press, but turned out to be incredibly positive with every stakeholder? 95% of of employees privately. All the investors were telling him it was a great thing. And then what he says is, the only sense I can make of it is there's a huge mismatch right now between people's stated and revealed preferences. And we're operating in an environment of virtue signaling and fear of speaking up. So to me, this is the point of this tweet storm and bringing it up now, is without people like Brian standing up and saying what the truth is, that look, everybody wants this. They're just afraid to articulate the principle. We keep encouraging this climate of fear. And, you know, the alternative to Coinbase, you know, one of the other companies we've talked about is Apple. I mean, you can basically choose to be Coinbase or Apple. What has Apple done? They booted out Antonio Garcia Martinez because of a passage in his book that they knew about. And ever since then, the company's been roiled by boycotts and petition writing from the employees about some new cause every couple of weeks.
And eventually that'll show up in the operating results of the business. It's just a matter of time.
Right. And so why does that go on? I mean, I'm sure most employees at Apple don't want to be, you know, constantly roiled by these like petition campaigns. But they have to put up with it because everyone's so afraid to speak up. And that's why it's important that what Brian did, we have to basically recognize that this woke mob who's cowed everyone to silence is maybe 5% of these companies. And if everybody just acts like Brian, the problem will be over.
Well, we know what the trail of breadcrumbs is right now. And I think we should probably, you know, shine a light on it, which is that 5% is exactly the same as Donald Trump. They just exist on the left, you know. And there's more and more research that shows that just as much as we thought they were right authoritarians, they're also left authoritarians. And this is what we're seeing, that the craziness that, you know, everybody decries on the right actually also exists on the left.
And to just put a button on that before we pivot to the next story, Armstrong was very clear that the mission is about global wealth inequality. So staying focused on that, in his mind, is the high order a bit and will result in the most great change. So paradoxically or ironically, you know, all these woke people attacking Coinbase might do more for wealth inequality and justice in the world if they stay focused than if they try to tackle everything. And, you know, this is a road to nowhere for Apple. I think, Sachs, you pointed this out about how if you were running Apple, you would fire anybody who does the petition, because I'll tell you where Apple is about to basically land. By enabling all of this woke mob inside their own company, by coddling them, addressing them, and not keeping them focused, they will eventually get to the fact that China is, you know, has 3 million Uyghurs in a concentration camp, and those Uyghurs are proven to be providing, through slave labor, equipment and components to companies that eventually make their way to Apple products. Ergo, Apple supports slavery. And that's what the employees will eventually get to. And that will cause chaos.
But there's something even closer to home. That's probably true, or could be true. I don't know.
It is true.
But, you know, the fact that Apple had the most important security leak in their entire software career just a few months ago is also quite important. Like, you had a So the iOS 14.8 exists because of why? Because a researcher or a set of researchers in Toronto discovered that there was a zero-click exploit in iOS that allowed you to basically turn on the microphone, turn on the camera, you know, grab anything you needed from iPhones. It was the most secure device until 2 months ago, where it turned out it was actually the most insecure device.
So you're saying?
I tend to think those kinds of technical mistakes happen when people take their eye off the ball. And I think people take their eye off the ball because they're demoralized with dealing with distractions.
Sachs?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's whether it's the Uyghurs or the security issue, it's a good example of the employees at Apple see the speck in somebody else's eye, but not the log in their own. I mean, that's the principle. And they would be much better off focusing on dealing with their own internal issues. But let's go. Can we go back to that article that Chamath referenced about authoritarianism?
Freeberg, anything else on this issue that you want to, before we segue over?
No.
I thought this was a really great article. Do you want to explain it, Jacob?
Yeah, I'll just give you a quick overview and then you can dive right in since you put it on the docket. Psychiatrist and author Sally Satel, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correct, wrote an article for The Atlantic entitled "The Experts Somehow Overlooked Authoritarians on the Left The main point here is that Trump's presidency sparked a ton of research and coverage of authoritarianism on the right, but mostly ignored the left, with some researchers even suggesting that the left wing, that left wing authoritarianism isn't real. In an email to Sattel, a social psychologist from Rutgers said the following, for 70 years, the lore in the social sciences has been that authoritarianism has been found exclusively on the political right. Why is that? One reason left-wing authoritarianism barely showed up in social psychology research is that most academic experts in the field are based at institutions where prevailing attitudes are far to the left of society as a whole. Sax?
Well, actually, Chamath put this on the docket. So, Chamath, do you want to introduce what you liked about it?
The reason I saw this and I thought it was so interesting was basically we had an entire body of research trying to understand why some folks are attracted to these authoritarian figures like Trump. And overwhelmingly, all the research at the time said they only exist on the right. And, you know, and all of this started after Hitler. And so there was all this research around the, you know, social and attitudinal reactions to Hitler and how he came to power, and then all of the iterations of folks like him on the right afterwards. And so people put Trump in that category, and then they said it can only exist there. But as it turns out, when this person did this research and she surveyed 7,000 people, and all of this data was very well summarized in this Atlantic article, which I'm sure we can post in the show notes that folks should read, lo and behold, it actually exists on both sides. So as it turns out, the extreme right and the extreme left are exactly the same. They're moral absolutists. They believe in themselves and themselves only. And they believe anybody else that outside of where they are is fundamentally in the wrong. And if you actually look at that and see how Trump behaved in his presidency, and now how you see how the left names and shames, you factually find a lot of commonality. So the reason I found that article interesting is that it actually says, again, what we've been saying, which is coming down the middle and finding, you know, reasonable compromise is the only way forward, because the minute you start moving in either direction, you are the same. And that person is an ugly person that we don't want around.
Let me give the money quote and then get your feedback, Friedberg. The similarities in the study included, quote, similarities between authoritarianism on both sides, left and right, preference for social uniformity, check, prejudice toward different others, willingness to wield group authority to coerce behavior, cognitive rigidity, aggression and punitiveness toward perceived enemies, outsized concern for hierarchy, and, as Chamath pointed out, moral absolutism. Friedberg.
I think authoritarian figures resolve when a population feels insecure. So, I mean, we talked about this last pod, but I do think that, you know, the notion of freedom emerges after the comfort of security has been provided. And I think the absence of security drives people away from the drive towards freedom. Like, when you have a feeling of insecurity with respect to kind of your ability to get a job, I mean, remember, Hitler rose to power when unemployment, you know, post Weimar Republic was skyrocketing. People, you know, couldn't get jobs. They couldn't afford food. And the authoritarian figure was going to provide the security needed, I think, to resolve the concerns that the population had. And then, you know, people latch onto that. So, you know, there are moments in time when I think authoritarianism can emerge with different forms of resolution. It doesn't necessarily mean that the authoritarian actor needs to take a left or a right point of view. They're just going to give you a path to security when you're feeling insecure. If you don't feel insecure, you're going to say that's ridiculous. So countries that are wealthy, countries that are privileged with the opportunities that maybe the United States has, are less likely and less inclined to fall in favor of authoritarian leaders. And then as we slip backwards economically, unemployment wise, et cetera, we're more likely to be in favor of those sorts of actors. And so I think that, you know, we'll see him emerge.
But don't you think it's crazy that we actually didn't think it could exist in one end of the political spectrum, and now it does? You have a point in that or no?
I never really understood the whole, like, Hitler is purely a right-wing guy. he was a socialist, and he was trying to enable, like, you know, socialized services and socialized systems for people. You know, in a lot of political circles, that would be argued as being a very kind of left point of view. And so I don't know if it,
Let's go beyond, Hitler. You're right. The Nazi party was a National Socialist Party. The name of the party was, but there's also Stalin, Pol Pot, Mao. I mean, if you're paying attention to history, you know that there's been authoritarianism on the left, not just the right. And so, but you know, in the universities and in the media, they only want to focus on the right-wing version of it. And I think what this study does is it upends 70 years of dogma that you know, authoritarianism is only to be found on the political right. I mean, it's obviously can be found on the political left as well. And you can see that in cancel culture, in speech restrictions, in these very aggressive COVID mandates that are now happening. You can see it in the ghoulishness. Anytime somebody in the right, you know, dies from COVID, I mean, there's always some chortling on the part of the left about this. The harsh penalties for noncompliance. I mean, right
cognitive
now,
rigidity is the one that stands out for me. Like, there is just on the left, they make a decision. Amazon is bad, and they cannot move off of that. Right, David? Like.
Well, what about willingness to wield group authority to coerce behavior? And what about aggression and punitiveness towards perceived enemies?
Cancel culture. That would be cancel culture.
That to me is yes.
It begs a good question, which is what socialist regimes have come to power without an authoritarian figure? Has there? I'm just trying
none.
To,
right, well, none. Generally, they're all revolutionaries.
Right.
And actually, the study has a really good point about this, which is they say that. The researchers describe what they called anti-hierarchical aggression. So one of the traits of authoritarianism is they call it an outsized concern for hierarchy. But, you know, leftists think that they don't believe in hierarchy, but actually they do. They believe in an anti-hierarchical hierarchy, which is they want to turn upside down the social hierarchy, and they're willing to justify the ends justify the means. In other words, if you can turn the hierarchy upside down, they'll let you do anything. And it's actually pretty scary. That's where the sort of the revolution comes from.
Here's a practical thing, Jake Hell, about what you said, which illustrates this point even further. Right now, we have a $3.5 trillion bill kind of meandering through Congress. And, you know, it's very much a question mark about whether it gets passed or not. And one of the elements that's in there is free community college. Now, when it passes, if it passes, there's a lot of support that that's something that the government should do. It's a good thing. But if you're a private company like Amazon, who just announced that they will give you free college, they're still a bad company. And this is the example of this intellectual rigidity that doesn't actually see the forest from the trees. What do you really want? Do you want the process where you control and you meter out progress? Or do you actually want the outcome where somebody can get a job where they make $15 or $20 an hour and also now get college paid for?
Yes.
I personally want the latter.
Yeah, we'd be much better if the government didn't have to provide that.
I'd love it if the government could pay for it, but I'm really glad that Amazon is in a position to pay for it as well. But if you start to become absolutist and say, well, no, this needs to be top down and metered out this way, and any private organization that wants to try to do it is still bad, I think that's where that rigidity holds us all back. It's unnecessary.
Here's where I see the rigidity, Chamath, is they keep saying gig workers are bad. Nobody should be allowed to be a gig worker. And David had a great interview with the ride-sharing guy on Call-In, in which they talked about the fact, and this is somebody who is super pro advocate of drivers, said, listen, 80% of people do not want to do shift work. They do not want the government dictating how they work. And I talked anecdotally with an Uber driver, said he's making like $70 an hour during peak hours. They were fighting to get minimum wage for drivers. Now drivers are making $20, $30, $40, $50 an hour. Uber rides have gone and Lyft rides have gone massive. There's a massive competition.
The free market works.
Well, and they can't take the win. They still right. are so rigid on the left that they're demanding whatever that woman's name is who is, you know, in the pocket of the
Lorena Gonzalez.
Lorena Gonzalez in the pocket of the unions. How cynical are they? The victory is upon them.
Yes.
People are getting paid five times more, yes. three times more yes. than minimum wage, and they still want to screw them.
The takeaway for a lot of people should be that your spidey senses should go up when folks present solutions as a choice of one source only.
Ah,
You know, when things can only happen in one way, and it's the way that I feel the most comfortable,
yeah,
your spidey sensor should go up and you should think to yourself, really? Hmm. Is that really the only way? Like, can't we have choice? Yeah. Can't we have different ways of solving this? Maybe we could run an
experiment and see what happens. Go ahead, Sax.
Well, I think your spidey sense should also go up whenever somebody is basically saying that speech needs to be censored for some higher purpose. You know, whenever people are trying to abridge and take away our rights and our sort of long held values, our freedoms, you have to start getting concerned. And there's always a reason why they want to do it. In the study, the quote that the left-wing authoritarians agreed with was, getting rid of inequality is more important than protecting the so-called right to free speech. So there's always some higher reason. The means always justify the ends always justify the means. But that's what you have to look out for is when they're taking away your right to speech.
Another fun proof point, fun because it's Dave Chappelle, that you can listen to or watch to see a flavor of this left-wing authoritarianism is called Redemption Song, which is a little clip he put out recently. And the entire clip is more about him getting his body of work back from Comedy Central. But the part in the beginning talks about folks on the left that really tried to dunk on him when he got COVID. And you should just listen to his reaction and how he frames it, because I think it's pretty powerful. And it explains that extremism on both sides, they actually end up looking the same.
Yeah, aggression and punitiveness towards perceived enemies. And I think that applies to anyone who defies the whatever the conventional wisdom is on COVID. There's another example in the study of that the people who the left-wing authoritarians agreed with the statement, I cannot imagine myself becoming friends with a political conservative. So, you know, you've got these social groups that are completely uniform. And by the way, there have been like studies for a long time showing that liberals are twice as likely as conservatives to be upset if their son or daughter were to marry someone of the opposite party. So this has been turned up in polls for a while, but this, and you've seen it on universities and college campuses, right? But there's this idea that, you know, anybody of the other political side is just suspect, you know, morally suspect, needs to be shunned, needs to be expelled. Like those are the people you have to be concerned about.
Yeah, you can't be friends. I can't be friends with you, Sax, because you voted for Trump. It's just ridiculous. People have this. No, but I think it's the derangement to give the other side of this. I think Trump was so extreme and so trolling and so great. I mean, if you think about his superpower, it was to troll the left and put them into such a deranged mindset that they did actually become that which they hated most.
Right, but he did troll the left. But here's the thing: is that we only hear in the media about the authoritarianism of the Trump administration. How many times were they screaming fascism during the Trump years? And now today, and of course, you know, if you go to MSNBC, it's January 6th all day, all the time. That's all they want to talk about. But there's a total blind spot with respect to the authoritarian tendencies of the left, which we see right now in COVID policy. I mean, it is getting so extreme right now. And I mean, Freeberg, you posted the breaking news that just announced via press conference, Gavin Newsom is now implementing mandated COVID vaccines for all public K through 12 schools in California starting this fall.
Wait, the students?
Yeah. All eligible kids in all public schools.
In all public schools, in order to go to school in California, you have to have a vaccine.
I mean, kindergarten?
Well, I mean, they're not eligible yet.
If it's when they're eligible,
yeah, they're going to be eligible very soon. I mean, look, so we have a 13-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 5-year-old. The 13-year-old got vaccinated. She wanted to. We supported it. The 11-year-old wasn't eligible. She didn't get a vaccine. She got COVID. For me, it was a mild case. And our 5-year-old isn't eligible for the vaccine. He never got COVID. Now, If and when a new vaccine comes out that our 5-year-old is eligible, I don't think he needs it. I mean, I'm not anti-vax. I mean, I'm glad I got the vaccine. I'm glad, you know.
Is he going to school?
My 13-year-old got the vaccine. Yeah, he goes to school.
I guess the question is, if it is safe, do you want them going to school, catching it, spreading it, and do you want them to not have to wear a mask?
How can you say conclusively What's safe for a 5 or 6 year old at this point
in time? It's a little hard. Their bodies are developing and yeah, you need some time.
I mean, do we really need to mandate this? I mean, why can't parents make up their own decision?
Because of other people in society who would be impacted.
You also see this, yeah. You know, look, I think vaccines maybe are a complicated debate because vaccines do actually provide protection. Let's talk about these mask mandates, which I supported at the beginning of the pandemic because it's all we had to fight it. But you take an example like San Francisco still has these stringent mask mandates. The mayor of London Breed was caught out at
dancing, singing,
at a
screaming.
But in fairness to her, it was Tony.
That was her defense.
She was basically like, it's Tony, guys. Yeah, what do you want me to do?
I don't care. I'll risk the COVID, which is personal freedom.
I had to give her that one.
If you want to risk COVID to play poker or see your favorite artist, I mean,
what do you want her to do? What do you want her to do, guys?
What do we think about? Let me ask this question.
What she said when she got caught was actually correct, which is we should be out supporting restaurants. We should be out supporting nightlife. Adults should be able to make their own decision about the risk they're willing to take. The problem is she's not willing to give the rest of us that choice.
Right.
And we can all make our own choice. And by the way, look, the idea that the COVID's not going to get you once you take off your mask, when you get to the table, you know, we've talked about
that's
this,
so
right?
Farcical,
you wear the mask and the maitre d' stand to the table, then you take it off to eat and drink, and the COVID somehow
in
not going to get
bites,
in.
This was the thing she was saying. She was like, they were like, you weren't eating. We have you on video. You weren't drinking. She's like, it's unrealistic for an adult to put the mask on and off in between sips and bites. And I was on a flight and I was flying coach as opposed to business class recently. And when I was in business class, I was eating and drinking. There was no...
It's an entire foreign language so far you're speaking. What are you saying?
So, I still...
most people pay for a plane ticket and then they get on an airplane.
So, but the interesting thing was when I was in business class, I was eating my meal, I was drinking, no issues. I had the mask off for whatever 20 minutes I was eating and drinking. When I was in coach, same situation, the flight attendant was going up and down the aisle. And while people were eating and drinking, if they didn't have the mask on, she was kind of being like a hole monitor saying, please put your mask on in between bites. And I was like, okay.
And when we supported this mask mandate way at the beginning of the vaccine, we all thought the government was going to distribute N99 or at least N95 high quality 3M masks, right? Yeah. We never got those.
Testing kits?
I know. And people are like walking around wearing these cloth masks, these loose fitting cloth masks. It's ridiculous.
It's theater.
The COVID goes, you know, through the bottom, over the top, through the side, it goes right through it. I mean, like, it doesn't do anything. And
yeah,
like,
you're the Lone Ranger. Yeah. How's that work?
I mean, if you wear a high quality, like, you know, PPE type mask, I think it might be helpful. But, you know, it's a marginal benefit once we have vaccines.
Oh, by the way, just as we end this, what do we think of Andrew Wiggins? Well, you can't comment on this maybe because you're an owner on the team, but a number of NBA players, high profile ones, in fact, in New York and California, where you're not allowed in the arena if you're not vaccinated, are now deciding to sit out their home games. So Kyrie Irving, being the highest profile one, is refusing to get the vaccine. And he will be getting paid. He's got a $200 million contract, max player. I think he gets $40-50 million a year. He's going to give up half of his salary. $20 million a year to not get the vaccine at least and leave his team to not play with them in home games. What are our thoughts on mandating NBA players who are playing inside an arena to be vaccinated?
Do you see Draymond's interview?
I did.
What did Day Day have to say about this?
He says he's so fucking strong, isn't he? Yeah, he was like, this is ridiculous that we don't like respect each other's, like we've made this so political and it's all like antagonistic as opposed to
recognizing
that there are differences and people have differences of opinion and respecting them and embracing each other for those differences rather than like attacking each other and finding fault in each other.
And forcing them.
Yeah, and it's a great point, but I don't know. I mean, I don't think that this point is any different than the point about, you know, mandating a vaccine for anything, any workplace, any school. I mean, if you're going to mandate vaccines for workplaces and mandate vaccines for schools, you know, the NBA is going to, you know, not be kind of excluded here. It's what it is.
Right. Just happens to be a bigger paycheck and a higher profile stage.
I think as a matter of policy, the right policy here is to let private employers decide whether they're going to require vaccination or not. I think private organizations have the right to do that. If a restaurateur wants to say that we are going to be an all-vax restaurant, you want to you know, and they're only going to take clientele who are vax. That should be their right to do it. If another restaurant says we don't care, people can go to that restaurant if they want. You know, I think that the free market can sort of sort this out. I don't know that we need the government imposing it. If the NBA decides this is what they want to do, they can.
The NBA has decided. What do you think of that decision?
Well, I mean, what I wonder about is how necessary it is. I mean, given the fact that, you know, all the players are young and healthy, and if they want the vaccine, they can get the vaccine. Look, I'm really glad I got it. You know, I think it, but I just, you know, if it, given that everybody is vaccinated now who wants it, I just, you know, what is the point of forcing that last 10% of holdouts to do something they don't want to do? I mean, this is where I think the authoritarian, I would resist the authoritarian impulse.
Friedberg, is there a new pill that's coming out? I saw a story today about this. I don't know if I want to cover that or go to unicorns first.
Merck published some results on this basically antiviral pill. It effectively inhibits RNA replication in viruses, and it's kind of it was designed to be kind of broadly applicable. It was, you know, discovered at Emory University years ago, and they were testing it for influenza, and then even pre-COVID, they were testing it on other kind of coronaviruses, SARS and MERS. And so the data that they just published shows that there's a 50% reduction in hospitalizations.
50%?
In hospitalizations.
Wow.
For people that test positive for SARS-CoV-2 infection, and then they start the pill within some number of hours. You take a few of these pills.
I think they said 5 days, right?
Yeah, they did the test on it was effectively, 4 or 5 days. That's right. And you end up reducing the percentage of people that end up in the hospital by 50%. Now, you know, so the idea is that for countries that don't have access to vaccines, you can very cheaply make this chemistry. It's a cheap molecule that you could theoretically produce at scale, and you could ship it all over the world. And countries that don't have, you know, broad scale vaccination programs, they can make these pills available quickly and cheaply. And then, you know, as people get infected with SARS-CoV-2, they just pick up this pill, you know, put it in every pharmacy, go grab a couple, and then the hospitalization rate goes down. We don't yet know if it reduces the transmission rate. So there's a lot of question marks on, like, does this actually solve the problem of the pandemic? It's certainly another instrument to blunt the, you know, the impact.
Pronounce the name of it. It's Molnupiravir. Molnupiravir, the government, our
and by the way,
government.
There wasn't a lot of people in the study. No one that took the pill died. People that didn't take the pill did die in the infected population because they split them, right? They gave some people a placebo and some people the pill. The people that had the placebo, there were deaths. No one in the group that had the pill, the actual pill, died. And so, so theoretically, we don't yet have enough data to know, but there's also a big question on the side effects. Typically, these antiviral, the RNA kind of blocking drugs have other side effects. They're usually pretty mild, but there'll be a little bit more studying. But generally, people view this as a super big positive. It's another instrument.
I'm going to make a prediction.
Here we go.
I think that the combination of vaccines and what is equivalently Tamiflu for COVID, which is effectively what this is the 1-2 punch we need. So that this basically is rendered.
You're missing a key piece there. The testing. You must have testing to know that you have it.
Sure.
To take this.
But I think that that's a. I think like the testing is. It's not efficient, but the solutions exist. My point is, if you have a combination of all these things, this is like a flu, which means that there'll be less ability for folks to not show up to work, which means that most of the economy will get back going, and I think then we can get back to really addressing. What did all that $10 or $12 trillion? How does it show up in the economy? That's where the inflation comes from. That's where all this other stuff. So I'm pretty excited by what I read today. But now my mindset is going to 18 months from now, midterm inflation. I think that's going to be what it's all about.
We ordered 1.7 million courses of this. I'll call it. We can just call it, basically this is the equivalent of a Z-pack, so we can call this the M-pack. If this. Hits.
Man, I've taken probably 1.7 million Z-packs in my life.
That's just on the way back from Vegas. Hey-o. So, I mean, this feels like the end game, and they are going for emergency use. So let's keep our fingers crossed. This would mean the stock market's going to rip, Chamath?
No, I think the stock market is in a little bit of precarious position, because if you have to reposition yourself for inflation, there's a lot of tech stocks that will get just absolutely obliterated. Like, well, when you have inflation, so the order of operations, inflation means prices go up. The government sees prices going up and they say, how do we control that? They raise interest rates so that the cost of borrowing goes up, so that then less money is being spent. Right? So that we become a little bit more restrained. When you do that, then all of a sudden people have to think about how much money you're going to make in the future, because if you're not investing as much in the future, you won't make as much in the future. And when you discount all those dollars back, there's less of them. And so all of a sudden you start to think about, oh my gosh, well, I want dollars today, not dollars 10 years from now. That really puts a lot of pressure on tech stocks, because we trade on multi-year valuations in the future. So inflation is very bad for technology stocks. Inflation tends to be good for companies that make money today. Why? Because if I get a dollar today, I can put it in the you know, bond markets, or I put it into a savings account, and I can get more interest than I would have otherwise. And then separately, you also want to own things that are physical and real, because those have more value. So all of that has to then get worked out into the economy, and we have to make a bunch of economic decisions. So now the solution for that in all of those cases, though, is still, if you're a hyper growth company, you'll be okay. So if you're growing more than 50, 60% a year, you're fine. But if you're growing 20 or 30% and you're kind of a middling business and rates are going up and inflation is going up, you're in a very, very, very precarious spot. And
Sax, what do you think?
Okay. Well, there was a great article in the Wall Street Journal over the past week called University Endowments Mint Billions in the Golden Era of Venture Capital. It's basically talking about, I mean, these university endowments are like gaining 50% year over year. There's been like nothing like it before. There's so many unicorns being created. There's a separate article in, I think, PitchBook as well about the rate of unicorn or Crunchbase. Yeah. That the rate of unicorn creation, I think last year, it was like one every few days. Now it's more than one a day.
Bonkers.
And so, you know, we're getting multiple unicorns now created every day this year. It's just this golden era of VC, this engine of wealth and prosperity creation. So that's the good news. And to connect this to a point we were talking about earlier, if the radicals on the left would just allow the golden goose to keep laying golden eggs, we're going to have enough wealth and prosperity to pay for all these progressive programs in the long run. But they're not willing to wait. And so you have in Washington, for example, I think a political program that really could upset the apple cart. I mean, you're talking about a $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. It'll probably get brought down to somewhere between 1.5 and 2. Then you got a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. They've already spent $1.9 trillion on a COVID relief bill. This is after the $6 trillion
from last
year.
What would you advise should be the amount spent?
Well, okay, good question. So last year, the federal government generated record tax receipts, the most revenue it's ever raised, and it was about 19.5% of GDP. When Bill Clinton left office, he boasted about the fact that government spending was only 18.5% of GDP. Last year, it was about 30% of GDP. My theory on this is that if you have government spending as a share of the economy at around 20% from a tax and spending standpoint, things basically work, okay? But as you try to go up to 25 and 30%, it starts to break. You have too much deficits and debt, too much money printing, too much taxation, too much inflation, you become more brittle, and you start to, you basically are, you know,
unhealthy.
You're killing the golden goose. And so, you know, all we have to do is let the economy keep ripping. 20% of it is going to be government share, and you'll be able to fund more and more progressive programs over time as society gets richer. And by the way, this prosperity that's being created in the tech ecosystem, it's available to anybody who has a good idea. I mean, this is not, so as we all know, so it's not just government that's creating advancement and economic opportunity for disadvantaged people. The tech economy is creating it as well. And what I worry about is why are we taking so much risk in upending this whole system that is working quite well?
Well, the other thing is, this is all in the face of there being 11 million open jobs. There's 1.4 jobs for everybody who's unemployed. So the idea that in some way society is broken and people can't be employed, Now, these might not be the greatest jobs.
There's only 4 million. There's only 4 million people looking for work. There's 11 million outstanding jobs.
Yeah, I mean, it is bonkers, Friedberg. Do you think this is sustainable? What are your thoughts on spending and turning over the apple cart, as Sachs is saying?
The longer you guys have me on this podcast, the more likely it is you guys are going to unmask me as a diehard libertarian. I will not let my tendencies, you know, come out in full force. The spending is ridiculous and there's a lot of waste. So, I mean, I'll just leave it at that. What I think is interesting, though, is this unicorn creation system, this unicorn creation machine, you know, it's worth highlighting because I think that that Crunchbase article showed that these unicorns in aggregate were worth like, what, $1.5 trillion or something? So those are all private companies.
$3.4 trillion.
$3.4 trillion.
Yeah. So is that the amount of both bills?
$3.4 trillion is the total market cap of all the private unicorns, not just in the US, but at the world. And right now in Washington, they're talking about a $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. Same size. Can you imagine government spending basically the entire value of the tech ecosystem in 1 year? It's bonkers.
Right. And so this, but by the way, I mean, like, I think that that $3.5 trillion, you can kind of think about that as being the future economy of the future global economy, right? So the entire, I just pulled up the latest quarterly stat, but the entire market cap of public US companies today stands at $47 trillion. The top 500 are about $38 trillion. So, you know, these private companies that are kind of the emerging tech companies are, you know, call it 10% or, you know, 8% of all public companies today. And, you know, it used to be that technology companies started in Silicon Valley, sold technology to traditional industries. What's happening in Silicon Valley today and over the last 10 years or so is that technology, quote unquote, companies are becoming the next industrial companies. They are replacing the
profound
traditional industries.
Profound insight.
And so this is like what we saw, you know, Airbnb is a hotel chain without hotels. Uber is, you know, a transportation company without vehicles.
DoorDash.
But even more importantly, there's an entire emergent class of life sciences companies, of novel hardware companies. And these businesses are leveraging their core technology competence to create an advantage in replacing an old model of doing industry.
They're not selling into the old school companies.
And so I think that the, you know, and people are freaking out about, you know, some of these big investors like Tiger Global coming in and writing crazy checks. If you take an index of the $3.5 trillion today and said, you know what, these guys today are going to be worth more than the $46 trillion market cap of all the other public companies that sit today in the next 20 or 30 years, that's a pretty good way to kind of place your money over a 30-year horizon. I'm going to go ahead and put as much money as I can into the index of the private companies and expect that they're going to be worth more than $46 trillion in 30 years. I'm going to make a 10-bagger. That's a retirement fund for my family. And so it makes a ton of sense, I think, that these, you know, these unicorns, given the advantages that are evolving from software and life sciences and so on, do end up kind of playing out. It's going to be ugly. And what'll happen is you'll end up seeing the asymmetry. You'll see the like, oh my gosh, there's something that's 1,000x, you know, 100x return. It'll become $100 billion public company or $200 billion public company. And then there'll be a bunch of them that are going to die. And people are going to focus on the deaths and say this was overhyped. The bubble is over. But the reality is the index of companies today, I would be willing to bet 20 to 30 years from now, is worth more than the $46 trillion of all the public companies today.
So Chamath, one of the things we're seeing here, and you're playing a small part in it or a large part, depending on who you talk to. We now have over 6,000 publicly traded companies on U.S. exchanges.
No, we have less than 4,000. We have about 3,800.
Okay. No, we had 3,600 in 2016, according to the research I have here. According to MarketWatch, 6,000 publicly traded companies in U.S. exchanges. So what's
the
right number?
They could be counting
here?
The pink sheets and over-the-counter stuff, which is
we're seeing dramatically more publicly traded companies. Many speculative ones or ones where you're getting to buy in year 4, 5, or 6. Obviously, you're part of that with you know, all the different IPOAs through, what are you up to now? What's the...
Yeah, we have 6 tech SPACs. We have 4 biotech SPACs. Perfect. You know, I mean, I've started or invested in a bunch of others that have gone public.
So let's look at this through the lens of the public markets as well.
My macro view is exactly what Friedberg said. We are much better off with as many technology companies being birthed and being viable, because over the long arc of time, those companies will rebuild things that are today inefficient and broken in a better way. And the world becomes better. The question is, for a lot of people, well, what if the wealth isn't better because it's only, you know, a fraction of the number of people with a very specific skill set that many other people don't have? That, I think, is a valid argument. But then there's a different way to attack this problem, which is you could actually do something really meaningful around corporate interest rates and corporate tax policy that would then get it, right? So like, even if those 1,000 companies, if you assume that that $3.4 trillion 10Xs, that's $34 trillion of eventual market cap, right? That's going to be supported by trillions of dollars of earnings. But maybe those things only have 1 million or 2 million employees, but there's 8 billion odd people in the world. Well, the way you get the money into the government's coffers so that they can reallocate it to everybody that doesn't work at those 1,000 companies is through sensible tax policy that goes after the companies, because those companies will still do the job, right? It's not like you're going to choose to not work at a, you know, world-beating startup in a mission that you care about because of the corporate tax rate. Nobody's going to do that, right? So I think this is where, like, if you actually take a step back and think of the bigger picture, the answer is right in front of us. We just choose not to listen. This is why, you know, again, what Trump did was kind of stupid. You know, he focused on corporate tax policy, cutting it unnecessarily. And now what we're doing is we're fighting over tax policy. And part of the reason why this bill isn't going to get passed is because of corporate tax policy and trying to raise it again. But really what we should do is actually raise it, leave personal rates roughly where they are. You know, Elon even said, when asked by Kara Swisher this week, he's like, I pay 53% taxes. What about you?
Yeah. You know? And it's going to 57. And, you know, it's
53, 57, 61. Who cares? Sure. Yeah. Whatever. No, it's all the same.
And he has to, the point he made was, listen, the ProPublica article was really disingenuous. They said he got a tax refund and they never explained. Well, that's because he overpaid his taxes massively the year before. So they're selectively pulling information. And the fact is, he said, I will be the first money into SpaceX and Tesla. I'll be the last money out. That is something we want more founders to do, which is never sell their shares and have more skin in the game.
Sorry, I'm sorry. I disagree with that. I think that that's a bunch of fucking malarkey.
Why?
If you choose to not sell, so be it.
Okay.
But look at the good that Bill Gates has done by selling down Microsoft. Shouldn't exist. The Bill Gates Foundation shouldn't exist.
No.
All the reproductive protection. It had to be paid somehow.
He did that when he hit 60 years old. I'm sure
He started to do it when he was 40 years old, Jason.
And Elon sold PayPal, and he was able to use that money to reinvest in Tesla and SpaceX. Anyway, I think Elon's
putting all the money back into two companies that are solving two major issues for humanity.
But he wouldn't have been able to do that if he hadn't sold in the first
place. Exactly. My point is, let's not conflate the problem. If you generate wealth, I think that you should be bound, morally bound by society, to put the money back to work. He chooses to put the money back to work by reinvesting so aggressively into the things that he's doing. That's laudable.
Yeah, I think that's virtuous. Yeah.
I agree. But it's not the only way. Bill Gates took a different path, which is to basically take all those profits, sell it down, to then be able to go and put it into the Gates Foundation. People will take multiple paths. The point that's the same among all these people is there's a moral obligation they feel to do the right thing for the future.
We're in agreement.
So let's just celebrate that, not some tactical thing about buying and selling stock.
By the way, one other point I'd make, Chamath, like you said that, you know, we should tax the wealth creation and distribute it. There's another way to get that redistribution of wealth, which is to enable access to the investments earlier by public pension funds, by the endowments, by the places where people, by the retirement funds,
yes,
where, you know, a broader swath of the population, you know, have savings sitting.
And change, you know, the accreditation
we've,
laws.
We've historically kind of forced the narrative that everyone in the United States needs to have a home and have 80, 90% of their wealth tied up in a piece of real estate. And then we end up with these massive kind of inflationary bubbles to keep that value, that book value kind of growing for them. The reality is, if that money was put more productively into building businesses via retirement funds that had access to venture capital, the public pension funds already do, but they probably underallocate to venture capital today relative to where they're putting
The endowments crushing it.
Look at the returns.
That's another way, by the way. If that was the model, you wouldn't need to tax, right?
One of the brilliant provisions in this reconciliation bill is they're actually disallowing retirement funds to invest in alternative assets, including startups and venture capital
funds. Insane. That is so wrong. So friggin' wrong.
Yeah.
What?
That's in there.
They literally are taking pension funds and saying, you can't have access to them.
You as an individual through a 401k or IRA, cannot invest in alternative assets.
That's the Peter Thiel rule, right?
Yes, partly in response to that.
Well, they should just make it a cap. Don't you think they should cap Peter Thiel's
Why cap anything? Because
it was against the spirit of it. The spirit of the Roth was, let's discuss this as a specific issue. I'll tee it up for you, Sax. Peter Thiel put his Facebook stock in his Roth. And yeah, you're supposed to get that tax-free so you can have a great retirement. He did that as an end run around paying taxes on the Facebook investment that became worth billions of dollars reportedly. So now they're saying you can have a Roth, but anything above $50 billion, you got to pay tax on, because the goal here isn't for you to use it as a shelter against some massive venture gains. Sax.
I don't have a huge problem with them putting a cap on the benefit of these accounts. However, my issue with what's in the bill, there's a couple of issues. One is, like we said, they're disallowing investments in alternatives, which I just think is bad for savers. Why would you want to do that? Stupid. Second is the treatment of what happens when you exceed the cap. And right now, what they're saying is you have to distribute out all of those funds and then subject them to immediate taxation at ordinary income rates, which is confiscatory, because you could have made the investment outside the retirement account and paid long-term cap gains rates.
Long-term tax, of course.
Yeah, and furthermore, it's even worse than that, because what they're saying is, let's say that you do have an alternative, like an investment in a startup or a venture fund, you have to distribute it out and pay tax on that, even though that investment is not liquid.
Right, so you should be able to take it out and just be treated normal cap gains and not have to liquidate it. Do you think?
Well, what it's going to do is going to give people an incentive. It's going to warp the incentives for saving, because what it's going to say to people is you want to do well, but not too well.
Right.
Because if you hit the cap, you're now subject to a confiscation.
You get penalized. Yes, it should be.
So it shouldn't be a penalty. Yeah, exactly. I think the way it should work is you have a cap, but any distribution above that, you basically, that becomes the basis for future taxation.
I think all of this can be summarized more simply. I think that we have unfortunately gotten so confused that we've decided to fix the finish line and stagger the starting line, right? Because all of this still doesn't apply to rich people.
No, this is vindictive against
rich people. Rich people can do all of these different things. They can set up these out-of-state trusts. They can set up generation skipping trusts. They can be, qualified investors, they can have QSBS deductions. And so what this will do, unfortunately, is entrench the kind of wealth gains that Peter Thiel was able to generate in a very visible way that will just piss everybody off. And I think instead you got to go back to a different litmus test. So Jason, you have been the strongest advocate for letting people participate in the economy. I have always agreed with that. We need to figure out how we can make that it isn't abused. But that's the best way, is to educate folks about financial literacy so that they can actually be a part of it. Even the starting line, let everybody be able to put stuff into this stuff and learn about it.
I mean, what Peter did essentially was put lottery tickets into his, non-tax retirement fund. Lottery tickets being buying stocks in private companies early. But regular Americans aren't allowed to do that. So rather than retroactively try to penalize Peter because you disagree with his politics or because he did it too well, I think it's better that everybody be allowed to be an accredited investor and do what Peter did, which is everybody should be able to take their 401k or their Roth and be able to buy the next LinkedIn Uber. So if you were a civilian and you took an Uber or you used LinkedIn to hire somebody in year two and you had an opportunity to buy those shares, you should be allowed to buy it because you're a human resources person or Uber driver, and you realize this is a great service that will change the world. It doesn't take a genius to figure that out, Freeberg.
Yeah, look, I mean, the downside is you see speculative concentrated bets that wipe people out. That's the reason the protective provisions are in there. So I think there are probably sensible ways of managing that, qualifying, pools of these investments in a way, creating indexes against them, et cetera. And maybe that's the right way to provide access. But, giving individuals that maybe, don't have the right kind of point of view on a particular investment, the ability to put all of their capital into that investment, generally, I would say go for it. The problem is we've socialized, protection, right? So, and this is the same with healthcare. in a model for governing or model for a state where you provide socialized care for people through healthcare, socialized healthcare, or you provide socialized support for people through, you know, the social security system and other services like that. It's difficult to say, okay, the government's going to be your backstop and is going to provide the support for you. And we're also going to let you take risky behavior. And that's where I think the two have to go hand in hand. If you want to get rid of one, you got to get rid of the other. And so, because otherwise we all end up paying the cost of the person that takes the, you know, outsized risk. And then we all end up having to foot the bill for that person taking that risk. So if we're all going to be there to protect that person, we have to tell them you can't take unnecessary risks.
Okay. Hey, Sax, let me ask you a conspiracy theory here. Peter Thiel supported Trump when Trump was teetering on the Access Hollywood tape, and he went to bat for him. He gave him a big donation at that time, then obviously did the Republican National Convention and was a key intellectual influencer in his election plan. Now the Democrats are in, and suddenly the focus becomes this one outsized Roth IRA, and we're going to rewrite the law so that Peter Thiel has to take $5 billion or so, is one of the estimates that I saw online on CNBC, out of his IRA. Do you think this is specific vindictiveness on the part of the Democrats to try to attack specifically Peter Thiel? I know he's your bestie.
Well, yeah, I mean,
it does feel, and I'm not a Peter Thiel apologist, but this feels vindictive and personal.
So yes and no. Okay. So what I would say is there have been proposals over the last, I think going back to maybe even 2014, on providing some restrictions or caps on, you know, these IRAs and the Roth IRAs. However, there's never been a proposal as punitive and retroactive and confiscatory as what they're doing here. And specifically, it's the fact that they're going to force Peter to distribute out everything above the cap and then tax it as ordinary income. I mean, that's just changing the rules. That part, I think, is directed at Peter. And I've actually heard that staffers on Capitol Hill are calling this the Peter Thiel provision. So let me just confirm that part for you. So what I would say is I think there is a sensible way to provide some restrictions on these retirement accounts, but the way they're doing it is so punitive. I think it is motivated by political revenge against Peter.
Chamath, what do we think of the number of unicorns being created in the private markets? Obviously, when a company hits unicorn status, I think they're going to start buzzing around and maybe knocking on your door, and SPACs and boards might start thinking about that. These companies sometimes have $10 million, $30 million in revenue, $50 million in revenue, and they're becoming worth $1 billion. Do these valuations make sense writ large? And are you concerned that this is a bubble?
I don't think there's a bubble.
Okay. Explain why there's not a bubble in early stage private companies.
Well, I think it's because of what we just talked about, which is that these companies, by and large, are growing at incredibly fast rates, and they are replacing legacy incumbents that are growing very slowly or not at all, with and who have basically won for a long time with inferior products. And so as these superior products with more nimble organizations get capitalized to go to market, they're just going to win. And so I think what we're seeing is a wholesale replacement of the economy from the old to the new. And so that's why these companies will do well. And I think it's going to be a really powerful force in the world, because like the world should be a little bit more efficient and fairer when you have all this modern technology working on your behalf. So I'm a real supporter of all of this. I think there's going to be even more. And I think, you know, the thing that we have to be comfortable with is whenever something goes from a fringe thing, which is what venture capital was, Jason, when all of us were, you know, first in Silicon Valley 20 years ago, to, you know, today in 2021, we're sitting here, this is going to become a fundamental part of the economy. And when that happens, there'll be more and more money. The returns won't be as good. That'll be okay, but there'll be a lot of progress. And so, you know, we're going through the same transition that private equity did in the 80s and 90s, that venture that hedge funds went through in the
2000s. Did you see all the different venture capitalists who are retiring? Bijan from Spark, the kid from Lightspeed, bunch of other folks. Obviously, our friend Bill Gurley is stepping back.
Why do you call people
Jeremy Lin's 50. He's 50.
Yeah, that
kid. Wait, am I doing something wrong here? I'm like busy creating a venture firm at age almost 50.
Yeah, you're on the wrong side of this distribution curve. Well, I mean, curve, no,
so what do we think's behind this? They just made too much money, and they're
they made a ton of money.
Or is it because it's too competitive now? And it's too hard.
They're moving to Wyoming.
I would say it's slightly different than this. I don't know. I know all of those guys, but I don't know what their motivation is. But what I would say is, I tend to think that the mindset of venture has a relatively short half-life, and I think it's about 15 years.
Hmm. Why?
And I think that there is because company building is roughly a 10-year arc, you know, like when you get into something early. And so I think that there is like a newness whenever you start. I don't think it matters what your age is. And then there is this sort of like death march that sets in by year 8 or 9. And then you try to see it through to returning the capital and making sure all the employees and founders you've been invested with land the ship. And I think what these guys did was get to that place and say, okay, I've had this 15-year beautiful arc. Do I want to do another 15-year arc? And for a lot of people, it won't make much sense. And then also, I think your patience to do it goes away,
yes, right?
Because it's like, you guys know what it is. We all know what it's like. It is exhausting. It's grinding.
The amount of drama I'm dealing with right now in my portfolio is bonkers. The bad, I don't know if you're seeing this, Zach, but the amount of shenanigans, bad behavior, fraud, lying, backstabbing is at an all-time high.
That would be your portfolio, JKL.
Yeah.
No, it's like, no, it's literally three companies. I'm literally dealing with three companies with drama out of 350. I think it's one out of 100 is probably fine. But I am seeing all kinds of shenanigans. Even in the diligence phase, I'm seeing a
Jason,
ton of bad behavior.
I meant something
behavior.
More tactical, which is like, for example, you know, yesterday we're starting something really ambitious in batteries, and I have to sit there for an hour, and we have to go through ordering the equipment, setting up the lab, getting
human resources.
And there's only so much of that you have the energy to do after a certain amount of time. It's important work. You have to do it right. But it feels a little low leverage. Now, for that CEO, it's everything. And so you have to be on top of your game to help that person. And I think this is where I appreciate their honesty in basically saying, guys, I don't have that level of detailed focus in me anymore. And that's important, because in a next generation of folks who want to put in that 15-year journey,
you need somebody committed. You need somebody who's super committed.
Yeah, and I do think there's a difference between being a partner in a large partnership where you kind of have your portfolio of companies and, you know, to Tomas' point, you're going to be on that arc with them. And then kind of building a firm from scratch where, like, quite frankly, I would go crazy the way that, you know, you're dealing with Jason and Tomas is saying. I would get burned out if I didn't have a team.
Right.
So we now have like a pretty big team.
How many?
Well, just on the investment team, I think we've got about 15 people. And then we now have a bunch of operating partners. So, you know, we were looking at what Andreessen Horowitz has done with services. You know, we had this big debate in the venture community for a long time about whether venture firms should offer services and operating partners. And Andreessen, you know, went hog wild with that. They've got like 200 people doing it. And I think they've proven that it works in the sense, it's not totally clear how much value they're delivering, but it clearly works in the sense that founders would like the services if they can get them.
It's great marketing, but it may not be necessary.
It's great marketing.
Because if you're a great founder, when you were a great founder, you wouldn't want Andreessen Horowitz telling you how to run your HR or doing your marketing for you at Yammer.
Right. But so what we've done is focus on bringing on not 200 people, but an expert in every functional area that a SaaS company might need, because you do want access to an expert when you're setting up the department. You want to go talk to the digital marketing person or the legal person or
smart.
You know, or, yeah. You know, we have an executive briefing center now. So we do believe that there is a version of the services model that makes a lot of sense. And we are building that. If I had to do all of that value add myself, yeah, I would burn out.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a very good point. I literally last week launched the syndicate.com/SaaS, a SaaS syndicate, just for the same reason. So I can build a group of individuals who are focused just on that and who have that domain expertise. But the great founders do not want you up in their business. So I'm concerned with like
that's why we have like kind of, we call it a teach them how to fish model, where we don't want to do the work. We want to give them an expert as a resource who can meet with them, show them some best practices.
Do you have people though coming to you expecting you to do the work? Because that's what I had happen sometimes is they were like,
although
can you find us a developer? And I'm like, No, but I can talk to you about finding developers, but I don't have a recruiter on staff. Do you have a recruiter
on
staff?
Yeah, we actually do now. We have three recruiters on staff. So
so you're paying $500,000 mm-hmm. a year to recruit for your companies. That's a big advantage.
Basically.
That's a big advantage. Is it working? Are you actually landing developers?
Yeah. I mean, look, we can't
Freeberg and I don't give a fuck about any of this.
All right. Well, anyway, this is us in the weeds. So you want to talk about some...
Okay. Well, just to up-level it for a second. I just want to go back to this like golden era point when we're talking about venture capital, because look, obviously in the weeds, we're going to talk about our problems, but I really think that what's happening here with 1,000 new unicorns being minted every year is just unbelievable. If you look at the number of billionaires in the US, I just Googled this, there were 614 billionaires in the US as of October 2020. Now there's probably more. I don't know. Let's say there's 1,000. Well, if you're minting 1,000 new unicorns every year, how many billionaires is that creating?
I mean, how many millionaires? More importantly, how many people who were making $50,000 to $250,000 a year before they joined the ecosystem and now are worth millions will buy homes, hire people, start the next...
But let me just give you guys the counterpoint to that, which I'm not necessarily arguing, but this is what I think the narrative is, which is that those businesses that are kind of, you know, accumulating wealth and accumulating revenue are effectively destroying the old economy and shutting down companies and shutting and
destroying
jobs. Wait,
there's 11 million job openings. That's bullshit.
I don't believe it's a zero sum game.
Yeah.
I think it's creative
but it's
destruction.
Disruptive. But it is disruptive, right? So there is kind of a temporal flux, and there's a flux of people across from the old economy to the new economy. And it's that flux that I think creates the great uncertainty and the great heartache that everyone's trying
to
solve.
That's the hand wringing. That's the hand wringing.
This is why it is so important to get corporate taxation right. Because if you're going to replace GDP dollar for dollar, don't focus on the fewer employees that work there. Focus on the largest number possible, which is the revenue that these employees are helping to generate for these companies. So if you had much, much higher corporate taxation, you can play around with all the personal taxation you want. But if a lot of people do get shut out of the economy, you're not going to make nearly as much for the government as you would by taxing companies more.
Chamath, should there be a backstop? Because we know tax law is so sophisticated, and if you're intelligent, you could make it seem like you didn't make any money because you're investing, you're distributing, yada, yada. Should there just be a, hey, listen, whatever you want to do with your taxes is fine, but X percent of your top line revenue is your base tax and you cannot get around that. Should there be something like that?
There's a couple things that this tax bill attempted to do, which could be really powerful if it does get passed. I think that corporations should pay a large tax. I think that they should be forced to spend a certain percentage on R&D. And I think they should be forced to spend a certain percentage on basically benefits for their employees. And I think that would do a lot to level the playing field. Then I do think that you can have much higher individual taxation, but you need to make it simpler because there's too many easy ways, like that ProPublica article showed, for you to play games for individuals to not pay taxes. And so you got to simplify all of this stuff because it's too complicated. So if you're rich enough to hire a fleet of lawyers, you will work your way around it.
Yes.
Period.
And they repealed it as part of the AMT was for corporations was repealed as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, I think. I don't know where that stands. But it does seem like a lot of companies.
I don't know how that makes sense, J. Cal. I mean, like some businesses run high margin, some are low margin, some are losing money, some are overinvesting.
No, it's complicated. Right? I don't have the solution. That's why I'm sort of saying, well, I think one of the optics issues here is, you know, people are like, that company didn't pay any taxes. That company sells this many iPhones. That company sells many.
That's because they're doing what tax laws were designed to do, which is to encourage investment.
So how do you fix it? Give me a solution, Freeberg.
I think that once businesses are mature and they start dividending cash and making distributions and they're profitable, that might be the time to tax them. I'm not sure.
Why would they ever do that if they had an army of people saying, hey, you don't have to.
You don't want them to. Because if they're investing in growth, they're creating jobs and they're growing the economy. And that's
the status quo is fine.
I don't think they're creating as many jobs as you think, but they are growing the economy. That's why you have to tax the corporation because that's the effective proxy for taxing GDP.
Yeah. Look, I would be all about, I'll wear my libertarian hat again for a second, but like I would be all about taxation if I felt like my dollars had a positive ROI where they ended up. And the problem right now is like government spending is set up in such a way that it's effectively been gamified and people extract capital from the government. And my dollars are not getting a positive ROI for me or for society. I would rather have them sit somewhere else.
Which is why you left, let's be honest, that's why you left San Francisco. I mean, it's just they're spending more.
That's not why I left San Francisco. I've got a family and I need a backyard. So that's a little different.
But isn't part of it that you are
San Francisco is a separate degree of incompetence. But yes, you're right.
They're spending more than ever. I mean, it's getting worse.
San Francisco is a whole nother nightmare, Jake. Well, I'm just speaking in general.
Or California writ large.
I mean, in general, right now, whether it's the state level or the federal level, it feels to me, and I think it feels to a lot of people, that dollars aren't being spent in a way that's generating a return for the taxpayer. And I think we all feel that way. And I think that's what's frustrating. It's not about how much one's being taxed. It's about how are those tax dollars being spent? And are they being spent in a way that secures the future of our nation, of our people, of our livelihoods, et cetera, and making, giving everyone access to opportunity? What's happened is we've created things like student loan programs and, housing programs and infrastructure programs that are literally just giving away money to private companies that are profiteering off of government spending.
Right.
And it's crony capitalism, as our favorite professor Scott Galloway says. It's one thing I really do agree with him on.
Pressure politics?
It is that there is this notion of crony capitalism where the United States and state governments and even local governments, as seen in San Francisco, California, all the way up to the federal level, are spending money in a way that I think we all feel is benefiting some disproportionately to most. Now, if there was a high degree of taxation and everyone was benefited in a meaningful way and those programs were well managed and capital flowed meaningfully to support everything we want to support, great. I think everyone would raise two hands and say, tax the heck out of me. Let's make that happen. But that's not what happens. And I think that's the primary aversion to high taxation.
Sachs, you get the final word?
Yeah. I mean, look, what I'm worried about is taxes are going up big time, no matter what happens in Washington. Spending is going up big time. We now have peacetime deficits that are the biggest that they've ever been. The national debt, the peacetime national debt's the highest it's ever been. We have a looming debt crisis in China. We have supply chain shortages.
What could go wrong?
I mean, there's a lot of things here that could upset the apple cart. And what I'm afraid of is we're going to look back at this year, the 1,000 unicorns being minted, and say that really was the golden era and everything happened after that. We really screwed it up.
Sex, you sound like the old guy at Starbucks that says that every generation and complains about the last generation.
No,
we're in the golden era and it's all downhill.
How much
from
does
here.
Music suck today,
normally,
Sex?
Normally,
I will say how impressive it is that 10 years ago, none of those unicorns existed. And it is likely the case that $3 trillion of value was created via private funding and private companies over the last 10 years. So all these entrepreneurs, all these employees, anyone working at these businesses, anyone involved in these businesses, should be thrilled about the fact that you from zero created $3.5 trillion of value in 10 years. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, I'm not trying to create nostalgia about the past. I'm talking about the present and trying to preserve it because I'm seeing some storm clouds on the horizon.
Yeah.
I would like to play the best song from Tony as we leave.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody, we're heading out. This one's for you, London Breed.
State approved entertainment. You can take off your mask for this entertainment. It's so good.
Do you guys watch Squid Game? Anybody watch Squid Game?
No, we have lives.
Nobody watched Squid Game. Okay.
My kid's been talking about that. Should I be letting them watch Squid Game or is it?
No, it's the most violent Korean horror dystopian show ever watched. They're going to be scarred for life.
Oh, I want to watch that. Hey, Sax, as a follow up, did you stop your kids from TikTok?
Did you take your kids off TikTok?
I went in there. I'm like, kids, what are you watching? I'll tell you in a second.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so did you take your kids off TikTok?
Yeah, I went in there. I was like, kids, what are you watching? They're like, Dad, get the hell out of here.
Yeah, and they said, tell us our names. And he was like, okay, I'll be right back.
Jack, if you could tell me to turn off TikTok by my name, I'll do it. David's like, see you later.
No, tell me my birthday.
The conversation was, what are you guys watching on TikTok? I hear it's all sex and drugs. They're like, no, we're watching dance videos. I'm like, okay, go ahead. I trust you.
The dance videos are literally like absolutely sex and drug-based, every single one of them. It is so deviant and insane.
Stop. It is not that you're so exaggerating.
I am not exaggerating. Literally, if you listen, take the most obscene lyric to, obscene hook to any rap song, that's what trends
on TikTok. Oh my God, it's
TikTok.
So true, guys. Every generation says the same about the next.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable, right?
No, but it is like explicit.
Pearl Jam. And, all the way back to the Beach Boys.
They said it about Elvis and shaking his hips.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But I mean, no, this, when I say it's explicit, it is literally explicit.
You just don't get the youth, J-Cal. You don't understand them.
I think I understand it a little bit too well. Anyway, the Sax, youths, do not.
The youths.
The youths.
The youths. The youths.
Listen, hey, guys, are we going to do the All-In Summit or not? I went to the Code Conference and I was like, this was amazing to get back
J-Cal, to. J-Cal, you got to stop talking about ideas and actually just doing them.
What are you talking about? We created this pod. I'm just trying to get buy-in.
Jason, pick a date.
Just do it.
Go. Like, just do it.
Okay, all right. I need your buy-in. We have a voting system here.
We're all in.
Pick a Miami. Sax, you bought in? Miami.
Miami. Okay, first year Miami. Second year Italy.
Not Rome.
All right, we'll do first year Miami. Second year Italy.
No, let's make it somewhat accessible.
I think we do domestic.
You have a cane, so you can't get there, you old fucking bastard.
All right, so here's how it's going to work. 250 tickets, 200 for purchase, 50 for scholarship, all in summit, 3 days, Miami. Sax and I are off to the races.
Why don't you make it more people, bro? Why do you have to keep it so exclusive? You're just so exclusionary.
What is it? I want to invert the top down hierarchy to what? I want to be a left wing authoritarian. What is it that I have to believe in?
That is what you are, a left wing authoritarian.
I just want to be rich and powerful. I don't care what party I am. I just want money, status, and power.
Yeah. Let me tell you why I like this idea is because to the points we're talking about with Coinbase earlier, we have these conferences in the tech industry, and they're frankly run by people who hate tech and the tech industry, and
they
people
love the
who are successful
tickets.
Right, exactly. And so I see these tech founders going up on these stages and subjecting themselves to these interrogations by people who hate them. And I'm like, what are they doing? Like, it makes no sense.
I'm putting up a form. I'm going to let people take deposits. I'm going to pick a month and we're going
to
go.
How many people went to the conference, guys, you went to this week?
The Code Conference, I think, was probably 300 or 400 by design. It was a third or half of
how
it.
Much, how much were the tickets?
I didn't actually buy a ticket because I didn't want to be in the conference itself. Because I was concerned about a breakthrough virus, but I did host the poker game with Sky and Brooke. Tickets, I think, are 8,000 for Code, and I think TED is up to 10 or 15.
How much are we charging? They made like $2,500.
We're charging $7,500. So 200 attendees.
Tickets, and then 50 scholarships for people who wouldn't be able to afford it.
So the gross revenue here, so we want $1.5 million. And so what's our cost going to be?
Cost will be $1 million.
And what? So wait. So we're making profit on this deal?
No, I'm making a profit because I'm going to sweep 500.
I'm out.
We spend.
Let me be very clear. Excuse me. We spend what we make. I am buying the wine, and you will shut the fuck up.
Okay, so then it's going to cost $2 million. So it's going to make 1.5.
No.
And if he's doing the wine,
no,
it's going to cost $2 million.
I want a wine budget so that everybody that comes. It feels like they've had an exceptional food and beverage experience.
Chamath is going to spend $500,000 on wine, no joke.
So then it has to be $10,000 a ticket. But you know what? The people who are coming can afford it. They don't care.
J-Cal, we're not privileging you with some profiteering.
I'm not profiteering off of it. Honestly, the reason I want to do it most is I want to play poker for 3 days, and I want to have us, the four of us, interview the most iconoclastic, interesting people. And I want to do it for the fans so that some number of fans get to come who wouldn't normally be able to come to a conference at this level. And I just think it would be a blast. It'd be fun to get together.
Okay,
and
stop
meet
talking
the
about it and do it. We're all
okay. I'll do it. All right. I just want to make sure everybody's bought in. I mean, it's hard to get you fuckers on this
call. Set a date.
I'll set a date. Okay.
Not the first week of February because I think I have a.
I'm thinking March,
thing.
April. March, April.
Okay, also, not the third week of February because I think I'm skiing in Europe.
Jesus fucking Christ. Can you just give us the dates you're not gallivanting around Europe and other places?
Bro, I'm grinding every day here. You see what I'm doing. It's like, this is not.
I'm fucking working hard too. I mean, it's crazy right now. It's like, I've never seen the market like this. I mean, it is bonkers.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
What's that?
Enjoy it while it lasts.
Exactly. All right, everybody. We'll see you next time for the dictator, Chamath Palihapitiya. For the Rain Man, David Sax, and the Queen of Quinoa, David Friedberg, I'm J-Cal, and we'll see you on episode 50. Bye-bye.
We'll let your winners ride.
Rain Man, David Sax.
And instead, we open source it to the fans, and they've just gone crazy with it.
Love you, Wes. I'm Queen of Quinoa.
Georgie, because they're all just useless. Beer or fee?
What?
We need to get merch.
I'm going all in.